Tantor Audio, a division of Recorded Books, presents Walking with Spring, the first thru-hike of the Appalachian Trail, by Earl V. Schaefer, narrated by Danny Campbell. Forward. It was late at night, and a dozen or so hikers were clustered around a man who was picking a guitar and singing. The guitar was old, well-used, and loved. The man was of no more than medium height, but solidly built, with the kind of rugged face that in about its 40th year stops aging. The voice, neither elegant nor sophisticated, had a haunting, almost eerie quality that compelled attention. The song spoke of a lonely hiker sitting at Hawk Rock, high above the Susquehanna River, watching below him the lights of Duncannon. This is one of my earliest recollections of Earl Schaefer. It was at one of the periodic hikers' gatherings that I had started attending. I no longer remember which one, although it doesn't really matter. Earl had drifted in earlier in the day, in a way that I later learned was typical, unannounced, and unexpected. His appearance among a group of fellow hikers is perhaps best described as unprepossessing, and it is unlikely that I would have taken any note of this anonymous man had it not been for the knot of people that quickly formed around him. Curious, I edged over to see what was causing the interest, and shortly found myself introduced to Earl Schaefer. Although I was then relatively new at the hiking game, I had already heard that name many times from many people, spoken sometimes with awe, sometimes with admiration, but always with respect. I was in the presence, I had sense enough to realize, of a man who had made some history. We exchanged only a few words on that occasion, and Earl spoke with that way he has of looking into the distance while he talks to you, as though he is just waiting for an opportunity to break away and head off by himself to the mountains. I thought at the time that he was merely being polite, and was eager to finish our conversation. Later I learned that it was his style. Of course, he really does want to be back in the mountains, but that is because he is Earl Schaefer. Earl is a loner, a poet, and a singer. He is also part of the song. He comes and goes like a melody on the wind, drifting from mountain to mountain, and pausing only occasionally, like the first time I met him, to tell his stories and sing his songs for a few who stopped to listen. It has taken almost 35 years since his historic hike to bring Earl's big story to commercial publication, but now it'll always be with us, even when the author is off wandering the hills. In words and a style that spring from the mountains themselves, this book speaks to the heart of every hiker who has ever followed a trail. The words are of the earth, but the message is for the spirit. It harks back to the ancient racial memory of the trails of our ancestors, the trails that lead to food, the trails that take us to adventure, the trails that bring us home. Not long ago, Earl was describing to me a tract of land that had been for sale, on the sunny side of the mountain, as he put it. He had been thinking of buying it as a place to settle down. The deal fell through, however, and some wealthy big city man now has a new summer home in the mountains. Earl seemed a little disappointed at the time, but I think perhaps things worked out for the best. Some people are destined to be wanderers. Earl Schaefer is one of those. Just stop occasionally, Ridge Runner, and let us hear your stories and your songs. Maurice J. Forrester, Jr., Du Bois Town, Pennsylvania, February 1983. Introduction. Trail called Appalachian. The Appalachian Trail in 1948 had reached a critical point in its history. Maintenance had lapsed in many areas during World War II, with many active workers serving in the armed services. Storm damage, logging operations, and natural growth had erased or cluttered much of the trailway. Marking often was faded or gone. The famous footpath seemed on the way to oblivion. Even the people who had done most to bring the trail to tentative completion a few years before the war were doubtful about its future. With this in mind, a meeting of the Appalachian Trail Conference was set for June of that year at Fontana Village in North Carolina to rally the member groups and individuals for an attempt at restoration. While in session, the conference received by mail a message informing them that I had started from Mount Oglethorpe in Georgia April 4th and was now passing through eastern New York State, and was expecting to reach Katahdin in Maine about August 1st. The arrival actually was August 5th, a total of 4 months and 4 hours to cover the 2,050-mile trek. So far as is known, this was the first end-to-end continuous trip over the AT. Publicity by way of an Associated Press story from Millinocket, Maine, written by Mrs. Dean Chase, appeared in many newspapers across the country, and even inspired a few editorials. This, along with stories about the trail in National Geographic and Reader's Digest, and mention in numerous books and magazines, helped revive interest in the trail project. Conference officials were skeptical at first. An article had appeared in Appalachian Trailway News, written by editor Gene Stevenson and conference chairman Myron Avery while I was en route, explaining why such a trip was almost impossible. Gene was the first conference official to discuss the trip with me. The discussion was long, held at the dedication of a Potomac Appalachian Trail Club shelter cabin, and actually was a charming but thorough cross-examination. Gene, who had a doctorate in law, worked in the Bureau of Supplies and Accounts in the Navy Department. She had a personal library of thousands of books, was a top-ranking genealogist, a conversationalist on any subject, and one of the most dedicated people who ever worked on the trail project. She said that the first thing Myron Avery said after the newspaper story was, "I wonder if he did." After I submitted a day-by-day report, showed hundreds of color slides, and talked for hours about various parts of the AT, the trip was accepted as fact. Meanwhile, messages came to headquarters from many people who had seen me en route. Building the Appalachian Trail had begun 25 years before, after publication of an article in the Journal of the American Institute of Architects titled "An Appalachian Trail, a Project in Regional Planning." The author was Benton McKay, a man of vision whose life was almost a century long. During those busy years, he had pioneered some of the basic concepts that have since become vital parts of our way of life. They include the Interstate Highway System, the Tennessee Valley Authority, regional planning of city parks, regional flood control, and rural electrification. He participated with Gifford Pinchot in establishment of national forests and parks. He also was co-founder of the Wilderness Society, co-author of the Encyclopedia Britannica article on regional planning, and author of various works on conservation and geotechnics. The Appalachian Trail was his great far-reaching dream, and the one for which he is most widely known. Enthusiasm for the outdoors began for Benton McKay when he worked and played as a boy on the farm of Melvin Longley, a highly respected leader in the community of Shirley Center in Massachusetts, who later served in the legislature. Impressions of this formative period in his life and of Mr. Longley were recorded by Mr. McKay in an article in the Fitchburg Sentinel entitled "A Mountain and a Man." The mountain was Monadnock, a few miles from Shirley Center and across the state line in New Hampshire. This massive pinnacle, jutting far above timberline, was the first high mountain he ever saw and climbed. It gives a panoramic view of the Appalachian mountain chain through Connecticut, Massachusetts, Vermont, and New Hampshire, and even shows the tip of Katahdin in Maine on a clear day. It is the only point from which all of the New England states, including Rhode Island, can be seen. Directly north are the massive peaks of the White Mountains, where an extensive trail system already was maintained by the Appalachian Mountain Club. This organization was the first of its kind in America, and for many years was the largest. During his college years, Mr. McKay met and hiked with members of the club. Benton McKay graduated from Harvard in 1900. The following summer, he and a friend hiked the length of the Green Mountains in Vermont, following existing paths in woods roads when possible, and crossing all major summits. This approximate route was opened up later as the Long Trail by the Green Mountain Club. One of the summits is Stratton Mountain. One day, while gazing from a treetop on Stratton Mountain, he had a sudden realization of the almost endless reaches of the Appalachian chain from Maine to Georgia, and the potential for a trail along its crest. It could be patterned after the Long Trail, but be at least 10 times as long. He spoke of this to various friends over a period of perhaps 10 years, before Clarence Stein, an editor of the Journal of the American Institute of Architects, finally declared, "Ben, I am tired of hearing you talk about this and doing nothing. You write it, and I'll publish it." The result was the article appearing in October of 1921. A printer's copy of that article inscribed, "To One Who Did It, From One Who Wrote It." It was given to me 30 years later in his home at Shirley Center by Benton McKay. The article, with an introduction by Mr. Stein, described the trail over the full length of the Appalachian skyline, with the northern anchor to be Mount Washington in New Hampshire, and the southern anchor to be Mount Mitchell in North Carolina. He saw it as a master trail for a network of side trails to points of interest or outdoor-oriented activity. Open shelters would be provided at intervals. The work would be done by volunteers, and suitable organizations would be set up along the trailway to facilitate activities. The accompanying sketch map showed the approximate route, with branch trails extending beyond. Routing the trail over Mount Mitchell later was abandoned in favor of the Smokies, and extensions into Maine and Georgia were included as part of the Master Trail. 10 years later, Mr. McKay wrote an article appearing in the April 1932 Scientific Monthly, in which he assessed the progress of the project, the forming of the Appalachian Trail Conference in 1925 as a confederation of local clubs, the completion of about 2/3 of the trailway, and a general summary of the regions traversed. During my first visit with Benton McKay at his home in Shirley Center several years after the Long Cruise, he spoke of the early days of the trail project, when he talked with anyone who would listen at points along the trail route. One of these meetings was with the Blue Mountain Eagle Climbing Club of Reading, Pennsylvania, which had been organized several years earlier. One of the members was Daniel Hoke. Danny, as he was affectionately known to his many friends, later was elected to the U.S. House of Representatives from Berks County. While serving in Washington in 1945, he introduced a bill providing the federal protection of the AT as part of a national system of foot trails. This protection was imperative because about half the trailway passed over private lands, where it was in constant jeopardy. Unfortunately, this legislation, though reintroduced periodically, was not passed by Congress until 1968. By that time, much of the wilderness aspect of the Appalachian crest had vanished forever. The first sections of the Appalachian Trail were borrowed from the Long Trail and the Appalachian Mountain Club trail system. The first few miles built especially for the project were in Palisades Interstate Park, with Benton McKay participating. Leaders in this were Raymond H. Torrey of the Palisades Interstate Park Trail Conference, which had been organized 2 years before, and Major W.A. Welch, manager and engineer for the park. Major Welch also designed the AT symbol that has long been the signature of the trail. The Palisades organization later was expanded into the New York-New Jersey Trail Conference. Progress was made elsewhere the next few years, and new clubs were formed. One of these, in Washington, was the Potomac Appalachian Trail Club. In 1926, Arthur Perkins, a retired lawyer from Connecticut, took over active leadership of the project and worked tirelessly until his death in 1930. He is credited by Myron Avery, his successor, with developing the momentum that assured completion of the project. Actually, Captain Avery contributed as much or more and continued as chairman of the Appalachian Trail Conference until his death in 1952. He was a very determined and dedicated man who worked ceaselessly in locating, building, and measuring the trail, spending hours in the headquarters at night in addition to his full-time job as an admiralty lawyer in the Judge Advocate General's office of the Navy. He was the first person to traverse all of the trail route over a period of years, and pushed his measuring wheel over every bit of it at least once. One of the Bigelow Peaks in his native state of Maine has since been renamed for him. Another important contribution of Captain Avery is his detailed history of the trail's early development. He told of the individuals who pioneered the route in remote areas, the most outstanding feat being, in his opinion, the opening of the Barren Chairback Range by Walter D. Green, Broadway actor and Maine guide. This dramatic effort through a wilderness of spruce and fir, quite beyond the scope of amateur effort, along with the labors of Captain Avery and other individuals and groups, resulted finally in completion of the rugged Maine section. The last link of the entire Maine to Georgia route was built on the south side of Sugarloaf Mountain, second highest peak in Maine, in 1937, providing a continuous hiking footpath the length of the Appalachians. The Appalachian Trail Conference was organized in 1925 to coordinate the work of the clubs and individuals who are trying to make the Appalachian Trail a reality. Today, it is the private, nationwide organization that represents citizens' interests in the Appalachian Trail. Its affairs are controlled by a board of managers, under a conference chairman and three vice chairmen who are elected by members of the conference. A headquarters for the ATC was furnished in Washington for many years by the Potomac Appalachian Trail Club. In 1972, the headquarters was moved to Harper's Ferry, West Virginia. Many individuals and groups were and still are involved in trail building and maintenance. Communication is vital. The Appalachian Trailway News was pioneered in 1939 by Jean Stevenson, and she edited it for many years. She dedicated a large part of her life to trail work, as did Marion Park, longtime secretary, and Murray Stevens, who succeeded Myron Avery as chairman at a critical time. Without such dedicated trail people, the project would long since have languished. It is my privilege to have known and worked with some of them. For instance, Murray Stevens, then living in New York City and commuting to staff meetings in Washington, also came to Pennsylvania over several weekends to join me in scouting, marking, and measuring the 60-mile relocation made necessary by the establishment of the Indian Town Gap Military Reservation. The years following the Fontana meeting saw a great effort by trail people to restore and improve the trailway. In this I joined, at Captain Avery's insistence, as corresponding secretary of the conference, and meanwhile worked for the establishment of the Susquehanna Appalachian Trail Club at Harrisburg and the Keystone Trails Association. At the same time, extensive relocations were underway at Roane Mountain in North Carolina and southwest of Roanoke in Virginia. These relocations totaled hundreds of miles and eliminated many miles of road walking. Many shorter relocations and the building of many shelters, including several by myself, greatly improved the entire picture. In 1951, Gene Espy of Georgia duplicated my south-to-north trip, starting the end of May after college graduation and completing the trek in snowy conditions. The same year, Chester Jane G. Levski of Connecticut and Martin Papendick of Michigan started at Katahdin and reached Oglethorpe in October. This was the beginning of an ever-increasing number of hikers doing the AT. In 1965, considering that so much of the trail had been changed, I decided to make a sentimental journey and traverse the trail in the opposite direction, from north to south. This trek began July 20th in cold, rainy weather, and ended 99 days later during freezing weather at Springer Mountain. The southern terminus had been changed years before because of encroachment on Oglethorpe. Private ownership of land over which the trail passes has always been a problem, but since 1968, when the National Trails System Act designated the Appalachian Trail as one of the nation's first national scenic trails, federal and state actions have made considerable progress toward achieving permanent protection for the trail route. Favorable congressional appropriations for land acquisition in 1978 enabled the National Park Service, along with the U.S. Forest Service and the states, to increase efforts to provide a permanent route and buffer zone. The goal is protection of the entire length of the AT by 1985. I suggested several years ago that expansion of the original project was logical. Trails are being built along the Alleghenies west of the Great Valley by local groups, much as the AT was built. These could be linked together and then joined at the southern and northern ends with the existing trail to form a giant loop about 5,000 miles long, a truly endless trail that would encompass the entire Appalachian mountain system. I am certain that Benton McKay would have concurred enthusiastically. He died several years ago at the age of 97, but his spirit lives on in his writings, in the Wilderness Society, and in the world-famous trail he fathered more than 60 years ago. 1. The Cloud-High Hills. There's a lone footpath along the crest of the Appalachian chain, on the cloud-high hills so richly blessed with sun and wind and rain. Oglethorpe, southern terminus of the Appalachian Trail, a mountain footpath extending 2,050 miles to Mount Katahdin in Maine. The board sign was battered and weather-beaten, its posts held up by a heap of gathered stones. A wintry wind gusted across the bleak and isolated summit, rustling brown leaves among the scraggly grass and muttering through the surrounding trees and brush. Midway of the clearing stood a tall white shaft of native marble, honoring the founder of the state of Georgia. Below the sunrise lay the Piedmont foothills deep in shadow. Southward and barely visible in the early daylight was Stone Mountain, near the city of Atlanta. To the west stretched the rolling countryside of northwestern Georgia and the little town of Jasper. I had come to Oglethorpe the previous day by way of the town, after a journey from Gainesville, first on foot and then on a ramshackle and overloaded bus. In Jasper, when asked which of the peaks on the eastern skyline was Oglethorpe, a man hesitated before drawling, "I don't rightly know, mister, but it's one of them tops out there." Along a gravel road in that direction, a logging truck stopped and the driver offered a ride. As we rattled along, a boy riding on the back mentioned that another hiker had started the week before, adding, "At least you won't need to worry about rattlesnakes. It's too early for them to be crawling." At the ridge crest, they directed me along the gravel road leading southward to the peak. Soon a truck came lurching along, and the driver asked if I had seen his foxhounds, which had gotten loose and were chasing deer. He gave me his phone number in case I saw them, but didn't say where I was to call from. Reaching the summit of Oglethorpe near sundown and finding it exposed to a cold and merciless wind, I backtracked to a rickety lean-to near a rickety fire tower and stayed there. The little black notebook says, "Got cold and blustery toward morning. Hated like poison to get up. At least the scramble back to the summit warmed me up a little. And now the time had come. This was the threshold of my great adventure, long delayed by World War II and without my trail partner, who had been killed on Iwo Jima. Those 4.5 years of Army service, more than half of it in combat areas of the Pacific, without furlough or even rest leave, had left me confused and depressed. Perhaps this trip would be the answer. Late in 1947, I had seen an article in an outdoor magazine entitled The Long Trails Challenge. It said that no one was known to have hiked the entire trail in a continuous journey, though many had tried, and such a trip might actually be impossible. Suddenly the old dream came alive. Why not walk the army out of my system, both mentally and physically? Take pictures and notes along the way. Make a regular expedition out of it. The trail would benefit at a time when it was at low ebb. My background on running the brush in all kinds of weather, based on the writings of such men as Nessmuk and Grey Owl, should carry me through. Surely those years of trailing with Walter, when we first heard of the Appalachian Trail and wanted to walk it, would be an asset now. The launching of the long cruise was totally lacking in ceremony. I looked at the battered sign for the last time while the shrill wind seemed to be saying, "Get moving, Ridge Runner, the trail is calling, and Katahdin is far away." My mountain troop rucksack was bulky and heavy as I slung it to my shoulders and started off. In it were an Air Corps survival tent, a Marine Corps poncho, a rain hat, a paper mill blanket, Marble Company match safe and compass and sheath knife, small hand axe, sewing kit, snake bite kit, mountain troop cook kit, and food for about a week. Clothing consisted of T-shirts, navy turtleneck, mountain cloth pants, wool cotton socks, and bird shooter boots. The only item not with me all the way was the tent. It stayed with me about a week. My plan was to move north with the spring, with the seasonal change, with no definite day-by-day goals, but never tarrying long, as weather and terrain permitted. The early start from the south would allow a maximum of at least 6 months to reach and cross the timberline of New England. I hoped to maintain an average daily distance of close to 20 miles, but would settle for 15. Another advantage of the early start was the absence of snakes and bugs. Also in April, true first month of the year, the woods are at their finest, with the budding and leafing of trees, the blooming of flowers, the full-flowing streams and waterfalls, the rain-swept blue of the sky. And the little old retina, rugged and dependable, would record the beautiful scenes. Breakfast was cooked at the rickety lean-to, which did provide a fire pit and water from a nearby spring. Next stop was at the road crossing where the loggers had left me the day before. Here I managed a self-portrait with delayed-action shutter release, showing a rear view of myself and pack with the lake at Conahaney Lodge in the background. The pack looks heavy, and it was, but not for long. My shoulders already were sore, and some adjustments obviously were necessary. Ben Franklin, one of the wisest men who ever lived, once said, "Experience keeps a dear school, but fools learn in no other." The lesser fools are those who learn in a hurry. By rearranging the contents of the pack to cause a forward shift in weight, and by discarding the large back pocket, it was possible to ease the burden. Long-distance backpacking is a rugged business and should be handled accordingly. Both bulk and weight are hindrances and must be kept to a minimum. My motto is, carry as little as possible, but choose that little with care. Meanwhile, a few wild flowers were blooming in sheltered spots, and sometimes a holly tree would contrast its brilliant red berries and glossy green leaves with the still leafless forest. Wild creatures were plentiful. Once a wild turkey flushed a few feet ahead, squawking and beating its wings, setting me back on my heels. Other times quail, woodcock, or grouse caused similar disturbances. The weather had been sunny, but now a buttermilk sky was moving in, foretelling rain. About noon, the trail crossed a road gap, probably the site of Southern Store, mentioned in early guidebooks, and entered a picnic area near a reservoir. Just then, four girls came strolling over a rise ahead. They were identically dressed in snowy blouses and long black new-look skirts, a very charming foursome. My T-shirt, gray pants, helter-skelter hair, and sweaty face were definitely not as stylish. They passed quite sedately, but one of them muttered what sounded like, "Hubba hubba." Beyond the rise, a family of three was setting out a picnic lunch. As I was passing, the man looked up and said casually, "Howdy, where are you heading?" Just as casually, I replied, "To Maine." A poke in the solar plexus would have produced the same result. His jaw sagged and his eyes widened. When informed of my trek, he admitted he had never heard of the Appalachian Trail. Meanwhile, the lady just stood there and...
Sample complete. Ready to continue?